without giving him the opportunity to misuse his letter. You know, right in the beginning, Muawiyah, basically to provoke him, started praising Rasulullah. That, you know, alhamdulillah, we had Rasul in our tribe of Quraysh, and this and that, he was this and he was that. And after him, you know, we had the Khulafa. He mentions one, then the second, and the third, and their accomplishments. This was all done in order to provoke Ali against the Khulafa, his motivations. So he now responds to him, and this is in letter number 28 in Nahj al-Balagha, where first Amir al-Mu'minin says, I'm really surprised and, you know, amazed by you, Muawiyah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The Afghanistan Papers. Pop.
In terms of capability, there's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of a embassy of the United States from Afghanistan.
Getting out of the U.S. embassy in Afghanistan from the rooftop. What does that exactly mean? August 13th, 2021, the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, transferring U.S. staff and officials with a helicopter. The fall of Kabul was like the incident that happened 46 years ago in the U.S. Embassy in Vietnam, the incident that was known as the Fall of Saigon.
What do you make of this comparison between what's happening in Kabul and Saigon in 1975? I mean, you put them side by side, there it does appear to be a just comparison.
But there was a difference. As U.S. President Joe Biden says, fortunately, during the incidents in Kabul, unlike what happened in Saigon, no one got into a helicopter from the rooftop of the embassy. Before the exit, all of the documents were burnt. Untold stories are usually more important than those that have been revealed. It rarely happens that someone can get access to classified documents, and when the confidential documents are disposed, it's like they never existed. But is there a way for the public to find out about the truth? Maybe the media are the only way. A media outlet reveals secrets depending on the degree of its independence. In 2019, the Washington Post published a part of the secret documents on the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. The documents were known as the Afghanistan Papers. A curious journalist at the Washington Post, Craig Whitlock, a person who had been investigating Afghanistan for a while and had been gathering documents. He published several thousand pages of documents, including interviews with scores of U.S. generals and diplomats on security issues. But how did Whitlock manage to do that?
2,000 pages of documents of, of interviews that had been kept under wraps for a number of years, in which people who were in charge of the war admitted that the strategy was a mess, that they misled the American public.
This important event happened after he got to know Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, an organization that was established by the U.S. Congress in 2008 to inspect the reconstruction in Afghanistan. General John Sopko is the head and special inspector of the organization. John Sopko is the most important U.S. figure in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. He agreed to gradually leak some documents to the Washington Post in his cooperation with Craig Whitlock from 2007.
Of any inspector general, I've probably been the most forthcoming on information.
The revelations by John Sopko on the process of reconstruction in Afghanistan during the 20 years were a clear example of burnt documents. Despite its economic capacities, Afghanistan is among the weakest economies in the world. Afghanistan was among the poorest countries in the world until 2020, if not the poorest country. Poverty is a natural outcome of poor economy and country.
Afghanistan is the poorest country in Asia. In fact, it is the poorest country in the world, except for about 5 to 8, depending on how you measure it, countries in Africa.
Under such circumstances, it isn't surprising that the country has been ranked the first or second country with the highest rate of immigration during these years. U.S.'s construction project was apparently an answer to the ruins in Afghanistan and was meant to prove that the U.S. has brought prosperity to any country it's entered. Based on an official report by SIGAR, the U.S. spent $143 billion until 2021 for Afghan reconstruction.
America's $143 billion investment in Afghan's reconstruction.
Yet, living conditions in Afghanistan continue to remain critical. So what happened to the whopping budget? The answer to the question has to do with the companies and contractors that have received the money from the U.S. government. So we have to look into the matter a little to see what exactly John Sopko, the Special Inspector of Afghan Reconstruction, has faced. One of the most important factors in the poverty crisis of a country is food insecurity. Based on a report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, Afghanistan was among the 10 countries in the world with the worst food insecurity condition in 2020.
Increasing it of those that are food insecure. As I said, we were already estimating 14 million. Now we're up to 20 million with a drought.
The biggest food problem in Afghanistan is a lack of protein. Meat or dairy products do not exist sufficiently in this poor country. On the other hand, the poor Afghan society cannot buy American products. But in a long-term reconstruction plan, the country can become a consumer of American agri-products.
That we produce a lot more food than we can consume. And so it's critical for us to find markets abroad and foreign assistance and the Food for Peace program and so many other programs like it.
Soybean, as a complete plant protein, was an investment with future in sight. The U.S. started investing on it in Afghanistan in 2003.
Soybean is a good tool for fighting malnutrition for them. And then it also helps us in our goals to build the agribusiness sector and create jobs and to legitimize the government of Afghanistan.
In fact, the Pentagon paved the ground so a U.S. organization can develop soybean production in Afghanistan. Nutrition and Education International, also known as NEI, that's N-E-I, based in Pasadena, California. The company's CEO is Stephen Kwan. He is one of the former managers of Nestle in the U.S. Nestle is the largest food company in the world. Kwan got involved in the Afghan food industry in 2003. At the beginning, his company was mostly like a charity.
When I first heard about so many women and children are dying in this country due to malnutrition, I felt that I should do something as a person who is in charge of a nutritional program.
Besides the Pentagon and the NEI, the U.S. Department of Agriculture also got involved in the strategic field of food in Afghanistan.
We not only have to win this on the ground, we have to win it in the ground.
Along the lines of this policy, the American Soybean Association, the ASA, supported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, signed contracts with the Afghan officials.
I am Jim Hershey. I'm the
Jim Hershey, as a representative of the Soybean Association, along with Stephen Kwan, was among the most important U.S. figures who entered the Afghan food industry. Jim's goal was to link soybean consumption in Afghanistan to the ASA in the long run.
Accessible, available, affordable, and acceptable.
The NEI and the ASA were after bigger advantages in Afghan reconstruction that would lead to bigger contracts. The interaction between Stephen Kwan and Jim Hershey led to a major contract with the U.S. Agriculture Department.
Is protein deficient? There's not enough protein in the market. There's not enough protein in some of the households.
A project that was worth $26 million to develop soybean production in Afghanistan. But the contract was only a part of the soybean fund for Afghanistan. After 2003, the American Soybean Association and the NEI got bigger funds, whose total amounted to $34 million. But in 2014, the Center for Public Integrity said the U.S. soybean project in Afghanistan was a complete failure. The center said the reasons for the failure of the project were adverse weather conditions in Afghanistan and lack of the necessary infrastructure.
And finally, a multi-million dollar project to cultivate soybeans in Afghanistan seemed like a good idea 4 years ago. But an IG report obtained by the Center for Public Integrity shows the project may have been doomed to fail from the get-go.
But according to a report by the Center for Public Integrity, the most important reason for the failure was soybean had no room in the food culture of the Afghan people. Afghans don't like soybeans.
And very important to us is underutilization, is the acceptability. Is the food tasty?
In this line, Americans took various measures to make soybean acceptable for Afghan society. Soybean was used to produce bread for the people in Afghanistan under the brand Strong Bread, and widespread advertisement was made to find a place for soybean in the people's nutrition. But getting to know about the challenges of the project in Afghanistan, especially for U.S. institutions, was not a daunting task. Then why didn't they choose a replacement for the soybean? Soybean had no background in Afghanistan, neither its production nor its consumption. Under such circumstances, it was natural that this question might rise: what happened to the $34 million? This is a question that the ASA has to answer. The soybean project, without achieving any good results, kept Afghanistan among three most food insecure countries in the world. In the end, the U.S. food project failed with a superficial answer to a major question.
The Afghans don't grow soy. They have no market for soy. They don't eat soy. They don't like soy. You know? So what a great idea. Let's create a program for the Afghans. So the fields to grow the soy are up here. There's no milling process. It's down here. There are no roads connecting. What do you think happens after 2 years? $36 million goes out of gets wasted.
The reconstruction projects were not limited to food programs in Afghanistan. Expanding electricity grid was among the main reconstruction goals. Afghan officials had posed serious questions regarding electricity. From self-sufficiency in production to even exporting to regional countries. But in a strange paradox, at the end of the reconstruction era, power crisis in Afghanistan became so critical that in 2020, speculations were rife that the Afghan power generation network cannot even supply itself with electricity. In 2013, 30% of the people in Afghanistan had electricity. In 2020, only 35% of the people enjoyed electricity in a standard way. This is while Afghanistan has sufficient oil and gas to fuel power plants and also has vast rivers for construction of dams and generation of electricity. The most serious problem of lack of electricity in the country was attributed to power outages in Kabul, the Afghan capital. This is while two U.S. companies, namely Black & Veatch with Van Dyke as the CEO and Louie Berger, headed by Larry Walker, were tasked with supplying Kabul with electricity.
Thank you both.
Besides the two companies, there was another renowned company, Symbion Power, whose CEO is Paul Hinks. Now, Symbion Power joined the two former companies as a contractor. The three companies signed a contract in 2006 to reconstruct a gas-fired power plant, but political developments knocked the project off course. The 2009 presidential election was approaching, and the people were suffering from the insufficient power supply. Under such circumstances, it was only natural that power outages in Kabul would turn into a political issue, an issue that Western powers of then-President Karzai knew how sensitive it was.
The campaign had just started to re-elect Karzai, and people were looking into what Karzai has done, and that question became very loud in many people's minds that they haven't been in power.
The government that they had brought to Afghanistan could not even provide Kabul with sufficient electricity. So, Karzai's political campaign, with the then U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ronald Newman, at the center stage, decided that the power plant should be established before the 2009 election, no matter what.
We were going to have a presidential election, so there was an issue of politics, but there was also an issue of whether power was needed, which it was, and could be done in a feasible way.
Meanwhile, in 2007, an area called Tarakhel near Kabul was earmarked for construction of the power plant. Carl Eikenberry was U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan between 2009 and 2011. He was somehow the successor to former envoy Ronald Newman's project. So, in a tight and unrealistic schedule, a power plant which was supposed to be fueled by gas immediately changed into diesel fuel. Carl Eikenberry knocked the project together in 2009. On August 5th, 2009, he and Karzai inaugurated the Kabul power plant with the minimum capacity for generation of electricity. He and Karzai inaugurated the Kabul power plant with the minimum capacity for generation of electricity. It was exactly 15 days before the presidential election, which was held on August 20th. Considering this, it was a noteworthy schedule 2 weeks before the election, so people would exactly remember who cares about their electricity. The project kickstarted with an estimated $100 million fund, but it was completed in 2010 with over $300 million spent.
And this was done in December of 2010 against a backdrop of AIDs having complained vociferously a number of times about your performance under the 2006 contract to provide power to Kabul, that The contract originally was projected to cost $100 million. It ballooned to $300 million. There were also overruns in terms of time.
Eventually, Carl Eikenberry Power Plant and Kabul to the Afghan government in 2014 in a splendid takeover ceremony. But the power plant was handed over to the Afghan government in a situation that, instead of using Afghan gas reserves, imported diesel was used to feed the plant. Under those circumstances, in 2010, the cost of diesel was so high that importing electricity from neighboring countries would cost much less for Afghanistan.
We are not using it because we have enough power from abroad and it is cheaper. This power plant is too expensive for us.
In the end, until 2020, the power plant failed to completely supply Kabul with electricity due to the exorbitant costs of diesel, because it was working only at 1% of its capacity. The $300 million project was known as the white elephant in Kabul due to its unending problems. The power plant was also known as the most expensive power plant on the planet. The politicization of electricity supply in Kabul created the best atmosphere for three power plant construction companies to provide a just, which was supposed to generate electricity, but turned into a diesel power plant, and afterwards it went on. They admitted that the power plant project completely.
Mr. Hanks, you were signed up as a subcontractor on the famous Kabul power. Now that came in at about $300 million. Is that what it should have cost?
Not in my opinion, sir.
It is obvious that they could not admit that the power plant turned into a diesel-run power plant because of the 2009 presidential race. So the best option was to blame someone else for the failure of the project, or say they could not reveal some realities due to security issues.
In Afghanistan, Symbion was engaged as a subcontractor in Black & Veatch for the construction of a 100-megawatt power plant you all know a lot about, up in a dispute and is now in arbitration proceedings. Fortunately, because of a confidentiality order, prohibited from discussing details that relate to the dispute.
Larry Walker, the CEO of Louis Berrius for many a road construction, was among incomplete projects in Afghanistan. The New York Times described that Louis Berger projects in Afghanistan failed from the get-go.
Already constructed is deteriorating, and if so, is your firm repairs to that stretch of road, or is USAID and the taxpayer picking up?
Absolutely disagree with that reporter's assessment. The reporter was referring to one particular crack that was on the road.
The challenge of roads, or totally lack of them, had caused other Afghanistan. In 2008, the USAID devised a mega-scale road construction plan across Afghanistan, but the outcome did not even fulfill 10% of the objectives of the initial plan.
That they started doing in 2008, 2009, the USAID in dollars in a project that was supposed to build miles of roads across the country. They've built 100 miles of road, and they spent more than half of the money.
Oh, wow.
Besides lack of roads in the country, rural areas, shortage of hospitals in Afghanistan is one of the most important challenges. Furthermore, lack of medical equipment is among major crises the hospitals in Afghanistan face. Just like hospitals that don't have the necessary equipment, many schools do not have the necessary infrastructure and do not have teachers.
Congratulations to everyone on Shaban.
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this most auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
China will boost defense spending by 7.2% this year, slightly outpacing last year's increase and faster than the government's modest economic growth forecast. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Global Times has covered China on Sunday, 5th of March, a draft budget for 2023's annual defense budget rise trillion yuan, or about $4.7 billion, an increase of 7.2%, single digit for the eighth consecutive. Analysts say that the figure marks a reasonable and rapid spending spree by many other countries around the world in light of global security tensions. It is part of the country's efforts to meet the need for modernizing its national safeguard national sovereignty, territorial and development interests facing external threats and instabilities. Defense budget growth was made public in a draft budget report issued at the opening session of the National People's Congress, the NPC, the country's top legislature, on Sunday, 5th of March. It is a single-digit growth for defense budget for the 8th consecutive 16. And a steady increasing pace since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. The growth rate was 6.6% in 2020, 6.8% in 2021, and 7.1% in 2022. Experts say the defense budget boost is reasonable due to the country's military modernization roadmap, the growing security threats in the world, as well as further optimized COVID-19 policies that encourage economic growth, as well as more military diplomatic activities. A 7.2% increase in defense budget means only a 0.1 percentage point higher compared with last year. And it is not high at all, taking China's national defense needs and economic development into account. Song Zhongping, a Chinese expert and television commentator, told the Global Times. China's gross domestic product, or GDP, growth rate in 2022 was 3%, so the defense budget growth is said to be restrained and reasonable, Zhongping said. China has set its gross domestic product 5% for 2023, which is significantly higher than the GDP growth rate of 3% in 2022, reflecting confidence in a nationwide economic recovery after claiming a victory against the COVID-19 epidemic and providing a basis for the defense budget increase. China is aiming to achieve the centenary goals of the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, by 2027. Basically, realize the modernization of national defense forces by 2035 and fully build the armed forces into a world-class force by the mid-21st century. China's Xinhua news agency reported on 1st of August, the 95th anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army. To meet this roadmap, China needs to gradually increase its defense expenditure over many years, and, in tandem with the country's economic growth, a Beijing-based military expert told the Global Times. National defense modernization consists of mainly the procurement of new weapons and equipment, the maintaining of a high level of realistic sizes of the troops, as well as welfare, to military personnel. In 2023, the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, more advanced warplanes, including the J-20 stealth fighter jet, multi-role fighter jets, at a time when the legacy is being decommissioned. It's also expected to conduct sea trials for the country's third aircraft carrier, the electromagnetic catapult-equipped Fujian. It is also expected to hold more realistic combat-orientated drills that consume large amounts of costly live munitions and fuels. The significance of national defense modernization has become particularly highlighted due to the deteriorating global security conditions over the past year, including the Russia-Ukraine conflict and a provocative visit by the then Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, to the island of Taiwan. That visit led to a series of unprecedented large-scale military exercises by China encircling the island. The United States and its allies, including Japan, have been making provocative moves over Taiwan in recent months. The U.S. military frequently sends aircraft and aircraft carriers and vessels to conduct close-in reconnaissance missions on China's doorstep, sometimes trespassing into China's territorial waters, particularly in the South China Sea, as well as the Taiwan Straits. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. China will boost defense spending by 7.2% this year, slightly outpacing last year's increase and faster than the government's modest economic growth forecast, as Chinese Premier Li Keqiang called for the armed forces to boost combat preparedness. The national budget released on Sunday, 5th of March, showed a 1.55 trillion yuan, about $224.7 billion related to military spending. The defense budget was neighbors and the United States, who are concerned by Beijing's strategic of its military power. Speaking to the Chinese parliament, the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang said military operations, capacity building and combat preparedness fulfilling major tasks. Our armed forces, with a focus on the goals of the centenary of the People's Liberation Army in 2027, should work to carry out military operations, boost combat preparedness, and enhance military capabilities, he said in the State of the Nation address to the Parliament. This year's hike in defense spending marks the eighth consecutive single-digit increase, as in previous years, no breakdown of the spending was given, only the overall amount and the rate of increase. Spending increase outpaces targeted economic growth of around 5%, which is slightly below last year's target, as the world's second largest economy faces domestic headwinds. China started a series of military exercises near Taiwan last August to express anger at the visit to Taipei by the then Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Li Mingjiang, associate professor at South Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, said defense spending outpacing the economic growth forecast showed that China anticipates facing greater pressures in its external security environment, especially from the United States over the issue of Taiwan. Chinese leaders are clearly intensifying efforts to prepare the country's military to meet all potential security challenges ahead. China, with the world's largest military in terms of personnel, is busy adding a slew of new hardware, including aircraft carriers and stealth fighters, to its military. Beijing says its military spending for defensive purposes is a comparatively low percentage of its gross domestic product, GDP.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Subhanallah. back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Islamic Laws, we are still talking about the rules of purification based on the fatwas by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid here. Sheikh Javid, you know, I'm going to ask you a question related to ghusl of janabah. If somebody performed this ghusl and wants to offer the prayer after a couple of hours, right?
Yes.
But he doesn't know whether his ghusl is still valid, all right, or he didn't do anything to violate the ghusl. Is that enough actually for him to perform, for example, a religious service such as the prayer, for example, or he has to do a caution here?
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, because he has done ghusl janaba, and we know that ghusl janaba is sufficient for wudu, then, of course, it's not necessary to perform wudu because he is not certain that he has done anything to break his wudu.
Mm-hmm.
But he has doubt. And because of the doubt, His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no objection to him exercising precaution. And precaution means that he can, but not, it's not wajib, of course. Precaution is not obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
This precaution is just precaution, you know. And as a measure of precaution, such a person can make wudu to rest assured that, of course, he is definitely in the state of ritual purity.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, does the wudu of an immature child become invalid due to wudu invalidators? Is it permissible to allow the child to touch the writings of the Holy Quran?
Yeah, wudu invalidators or these invalidating agents,
mm-hmm,
like passing wind, urinating, or defecation, these are, you know, the well-known invalidating agents. And it makes no difference whether these invalidating agents happen or happen to be with a child or with a senior individual.
Mm-hmm.
So wudu becomes void if a child, like, let's say, passes wind, and in that case he cannot touch the script of the Holy Quran, for example. If it amounts to disrespect, you know. But his Eminence says that touching the script of the Noble Quran is not haram for a child who has not attained, let's say, puberty, you know. Someone, right, who has not attained puberty, it's basically not haram for him to touch the Holy Quran. And it's also not obligatory for a duty-bound person to prevent him from touching it. Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
As long as a child is very young, he can touch the script of the Quran, and it's not necessary to prevent that child.
I see.
As long as, you know, the child, because we know some children who touch the script of the Quran, they tear the pages and the leaves of the Quran apart, and, you know, throw it away, tramples, that should not be allowed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of, it's definitely a kind of
duty to keep it away from.
Yeah, it's a kind of desecration.
Babies or...
Yeah, babies.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back with more questions after the break to this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions. Allah, yeah, Allah.
guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of purification according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, one of the body parts involved in the wudu becomes najis, ritually impure, after being washed. And before, of course, this happened before the completion of the whole wudu, the entire wudu. What's the rule regarding this?
We should understand that najasa does not make wudu white. Now, for example, I have just made wudu, and I happen to touch a dog with a wet hand.
Yes.
Okay, a dog is essentially impure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't mean that my wudu is invalid and I can no longer pray with it. Of course, I just need to wash my hands, that najis part or the impure part of my hand, and I can go ahead praying with the same wudu. I don't need to renew my wudu. So the same is the case with for example, with the scenario that you just presented. For example, someone is already making wudu, and one of the wudu parts becomes impure while he has not completed the other part. So in that case, that person can go on completing his wudu, but after completing the wudu, he can wash that najis part, and there's no problem. His wudu will remain in order.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. How about this question, Sheikh Javid? Does it make a difference? Does it matter if there are some drops of water on the foot while wiping them for wudu?
Okay. Well, we know that the wudu parts, not the hands or the face, but the front part of your head and the top of the feet should be dry, because when you wipe the front part of your head, there should not be any drops of water or any moisture on your head. And the same is the case with the top of your head, your feet. There should not be any drop of water. So basically, it is obligatory to wipe these drops of water off, so that the hand used to wipe the foot will wet the foot, and not just use the same moisture which is already on the foot. Mm-hmm. So that moisture should be removed, because using anything, you can rub one foot against your trousers or against the other leg to remove it, and then wipe on the feet.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about few drops, not a large amount of water.
Yeah,
do we have
drops,
to still remove the same few drops?
Of course, few drops are it's kind of moisture. You know, if you can find a space on your, on one of the toes, if you can find one of the toes dry, you just need to wipe on that toe. The other toes may be wet. There could be drops of water or a few drops of water on those toes. So you can wipe with your fingers on the toe which is.
So it doesn't matter which toe we are wiping.
It doesn't matter which toe you are going to wipe.
I see. Okay. Another question I may squeeze in here, Sheikh Javid, is that, we all know that you talked about them in the previous episodes. When it comes to wiping the foot, you have to do the right foot, wipe the right foot with the right hand.
With the right hand, yes.
And left foot with the left hand, right?
Sure.
What if somebody is amputated in one of the arms? Like somebody doesn't have, for example, the right hand.
Yes.
All right? So what happens? What's the jurisprudential law here?
Yeah. The answer is that he will use the hand, because one of the hand is amputated,
yes,
but the other one is there, so he can use the other hand to wipe on the
both
right
feet.
On both feet, yes.
Uh-huh.
On both feet, And for example, if the left hand is not amputated, right, or is not chopped off, then he can use that hand to wipe on the right foot.
Mm-hmm. And what is the duty, as the last question, Sheikh Sovit, here in this episode, what is the duty of someone who has a wound or a fracture in one of these body parts involved in the wudu?
Well, if the wound for or the fracture is not dressed and it is not harmful to wash it with water, then it should be washed.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it should be washed. But if washing is harmful and one is certain that it is going to be harmful, or maybe the doctors have advised him not to wash it because the doctors know better that water is going to be harmful, then in that case, the surrounding area has to be washed.
Mm-hmm.
And it is based on obligatory precaution to wipe it with wet hand if it is not harmful, you know. If wiping is not harmful, it is the obligatory precaution is to wipe, to use your hand to wipe on that fractured part or on that part of the wound with your wet hand.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Javid, for your nice answers to these questions related to the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.